Welcome to Playhouse 90, hosted by John Cameron Swayze. Or maybe this is New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, everything you know is wrong. Please stand by. This installment of our show is titled Everything You Know Is Wrong. That's an exaggeration, of course. Probably everything you know is a half-truth, maybe less than half. And when I say you, of course I mean me too. Here are some of the things I knew as a child. There was a dinosaur called Brontosaurus. The last planet in our solar system is Pluto. Capitalism brings prosperity to all and promotes democracy. Workers don't need unions. The North Vietnamese attacked the U.S. destroyer Maddox, floating peacefully in international waters in the Gulf of Tonkin. The purpose of the U.S. Armed Forces is to defend our country. And the greatest threat to life on planet Earth is, wait for it, Soviet communism. Ah, youth. Well, my excuse for believing all of the above was a pretty good one. I was only a kid. And every adult in the country was affirming the truth of all of the above. Today, many progressives and liberals have rejected many of the old lies that used to pass for truth. But we believe some new lies for no better reason than everybody we know is proclaiming them. For instance, many believe that there is an especially deadly type of gun called an assault weapon. And there is a type of ammunition called cop killer bullets. Anyway, today's show is called Everything You Know Is Wrong. We will hear from Ralph Nader and sociologist James Lowen, plus an essay by David Swanson. But it would be only sporting to start with the people from whom I have stolen this show's very title.
I don't know how you came by this record, but you are now embarked upon a journey that must certainly lead you to change your life forever. If you were never a special person, you are a special person now. Hello, seeker. Now don't feel alone here in the new age, because there's a seeker born every minute. Yes, I'm Dr. Happy Harry Cox, and call me happy because I am. Because you're listening to another in a series of my mind-breaking records, Men Never Lived on Earth, which started off with I Came From Outer Space, followed by Strangers at Our Door, which includes the ultra-high-speed recording of Real Gas Music from Jupiter. If you haven't got them, buy them now. I was right about the comet. Get them and see why. Write me here in my award-winning communication trailer, Space Nyan, Blue Mouse Trailer Resort, Hellmouth, California, 90666.
Dogs flew spaceships.
The Aztecs invented the vacation.
Men and women are the same sex.
Our forefathers took drugs.
Your brain is not the boss.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again, and hello especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe that pigs live in trees and that faithful Rover is nothing but a pet sleeping by the doggy door. Well, doggone it, he's smarter than you'll ever be. Yes, I've got proof here that his ancestors came from the dog star millions of years ago to rule the earth. He's been there, and you probably don't even know where you are.
Thank you, Fire Sign Theater. Here's a very nice essay by anti-war activist David Swanson, written a few years back. It's about a widely held false belief, Chinese and North Korean brainwashing of captured U.S. troops during the Korean War in the 1950s. Turns out, 1, there was no brainwashing, and 2, the brainwashing hoax was invented and spread by our very own CIA to cover up the real U.S. war crimes and atrocities to which the captured soldiers were truthfully confessing. As I speak, Memorial Day is just past, and Flag Day is imminent, and the anniversary of the D-Day invasion is now upon us, and the media are all drenched with story after story of American military glory and heroism and sacrifice. No stories about our glorious bombing of starving civilians in Yemen, though. Here is another perspective on U.S. military glory. I have edited the essay slightly. It is titled, U.S. Drops Fleas with Bubonic Plague on North Korea, by David Swanson. This happened some 67 years ago. Since the U.S. government has never stopped lying about it, and since it's only generally known outside this country, I'm going to treat it as news. You may have seen the film The Manchurian Candidate. It's fiction. It involves the brainwashing that the Chinese supposedly did to U.S. prisoners captured during the Korean War. In fact, people cannot actually be programmed like the Manchurian Candidate. And there was never the slightest evidence that China or North Korea had done any such thing. In fact, the CIA spent decades trying to do such a thing and finally gave up. The truth is, the U.S. government promoted the myth of brainwashing to cover up. During the Korean War, the United States bombed virtually all of North Korea and much of South Korea, killing millions of people. Sidebar comment, recall that South Korea, which we bombed very extensively, was the country we were supposedly fighting to protect. Back to the text. The U.S. dropped massive quantities of napalm. The U.S. bombed dams, bridges, villages, houses. This was all-out mass slaughter. But there was something the U.S. government didn't want known, something deemed unethical even in this genocidal madness. It is well documented that the United States dropped on China and North Korea insects and feathers carrying anthrax, cholera, encephalitis, and bubonic plague. This was supposed to be a secret at the time. The Chinese responded with mass vaccinations and insect eradication. That contributed to the project's general failure. Hundreds were killed, but not millions. But U.S. soldiers taken prisoner by the Chinese confessed to what they had been a part of and confessed publicly again when they got back to the United States. Some of them had felt guilty to begin with. Some had been shocked at China's decent treatment of prisoners after U.S. depictions of the Chinese as savages. For whatever reasons, they confessed, and their confessions were highly credible. Their confessions were borne out by independent scientific reviews and have stood the test of time. How to counter reports of these confessions? The CIA and the U.S. military and their allies in the corporate media invented the fiction of brainwashing. This conveniently explained the former POW's charges as false narratives implanted in their brains by the evil brainwashers. And 300 million Americans more or less believe this crazy story about brainwashing to this day. There isn't any debate that the United States had been working on bioweapons for years at Fort Detrick and numerous other locations. There is no doubt that the United States employed Imperial Japan's and Nazi Germany's top bioweapons killers from the end of World War II onwards. There is no doubt that the U.S. tested biological weapons on the city of San Francisco and numerous other occasions around the United States. There is no doubt that the U.S. tested bioweapons on U.S. soldiers. There's a museum in Havana featuring evidence from years of U.S. biowarfare against Cuba. Sidebar comment, and here's an example of interest especially to us people in Connecticut. Swanson continues, "We know that Plum Island, off the tip of Long Island, was used to test the weaponization of insects, including the ticks that created the ongoing outbreak of Lyme disease." Dave Chaddock's book, This Must Be the Place, collects the evidence that the United States indeed tried to wipe out millions of Chinese and North Koreans with deadly diseases. Why does it matter now? It matters that we know the evils of war and try to stop the new ones. U.S. cluster bombs in Yemen, U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan, U.S. guns in Syria, U.S. white phosphorus and napalm and depleted uranium used in recent years, U.S. torture in prison camps, U.S. nuclear arsenals being expanded, U.S. coups empowering monsters in Ukraine and Honduras, U.S. lies about Iranian nukes, and indeed, U.S. antagonization of North Korea as part of that never-yet-ended war, the Korean War, still officially going on. All of these things can best be confronted by people aware of a centuries-long pattern of lying. And I reply also that it is not yet too late to apologize. So ends a nice essay by David Swanson, U.S. drops fleas with bubonic plague on North Korea, from his blog of September 6, 2015. That's at davidswanson.org. On the subject of Everything You Know Is Wrong, a very nice source is the book Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's a very readable and spooky survey of the lies, distortions, and omissions in high school American history textbooks, written by sociologist James Lowen. A new paperback edition is now out. Let's hear part of a conversation on the subject between Lowen and Ralph Nader.
So let's start with chapter one, which is Handicapped by History, the Process of Hero Making. What's that about?
Well, it focuses on two folks, actually. A guy named Woodrow Wilson, who a lot of historians, actually, who should know better, and a lot of Americans think should be the fifth face on Mount Rushmore if they were going to be five. President, of course, during World War I. Focuses on him and on this woman named Helen Keller. Of course, almost everybody knows that she wasn't born blind and deaf, but soon became blind and deaf, maybe as a two-year-old. But she overcame and was able to read and write and even speak and so on. And what? That is to say, I have asked hundreds and hundreds of students, okay, what did she read about? What did she write about? What did she speak about? What did she do when she learned how to read and write? And what did she do, in other words, with the rest of her adult life? And about one in 500 knows, and often that person is someone who is deaf or who has some connection with somebody who is deaf, because the deaf community actually learns something about her. But we mostly don't. We just learn she's the little girl who overcame, you know.
Well, it's very true, because she was a tremendous progressive. She fought for workers' rights, women's rights.
Exactly.
You're right. It's all about overcoming a handicap, which, of course, was a spectacular breakthrough.
Yeah, and she did overcome, but then she did stuff, exactly. And in fact, she became a socialist, and she really became a communist. Well, that last statement, even the socialist part, is kind of a bad thing in American life. So let's not talk about that, you know. So that means let's not talk about what she did that might be considered controversial. And the same thing about Woodrow Wilson. In fact, just this morning, I read maybe a six-page interview on the web with a new biographer of Woodrow Wilson. And this interview goes on and on and on and never mentions the two things he did that I mentioned in this chapter. The first one is he was an incredible racist. He was more racist than any president we've had since the Civil War, or at least since Andrew Johnson. So, for example, he segregated the United States Navy. I didn't realize that it wasn't always segregated, but he certainly did segregate it. And he eliminated jobs. He eliminated black folks from the job of, say, mail carrier, which they had had, from just all kinds of jobs in Washington, D.C., in the federal government. Under his aegis, he was so racist just in the way he talked and the way he ran things that there was the terrible 1919 Red Summer, it's called, which was a summer of race riots from Washington, D.C. and Chicago all the way down to little bitty towns in the north that became sundown towns, another subject I write about. So he was a terrible racist, and he invaded other countries. He invaded other countries routinely. He invaded Mexico almost a dozen times. He invaded other Latin American countries. And finally, of course, he invaded Russia in 1918 in a hapless enterprise trying to take sides in the red-white civil war, and we took the wrong side in terms of winning. Well, instead, he's considered a great peace lover, and of course, he did push for the League of Nations. He did do some good things, but we have to teach people as they are. You know,
that's unchallengeable, what you're saying, Professor Lowen. I might add, in 1916, he ran for re-election saying that he kept America out of the World War, and then a year later, he plunged America into this brutal war, and the effects of World War One, as you know, in terms of the Versailles Treaty and the impact on Germany with the inflation and the punishment.
Yeah, it wasn't quite the war to end wars, was it?
Not at all. There's a straight line to World War Two in terms of the revenge factor of the Nazi regime.
That sets the standard in a way for Lyndon Johnson and the Vietnam War. That is to say, both of them, while they were running for re-election, were overtly planning to enter the conflict. In Lyndon Johnson's case, of course, the war in Vietnam. And both of them treated the United States public as something to be manipulated, not something to be informed.
Now, that's your chapter 9, See No Evil, Choosing Not to Look at the War in Vietnam.
Yeah, I've jumped ahead.
Right. Okay, your next chapter, 1493, The True Importance of Christopher Columbus. I must say, one time I came home as a child, excited. My father said, "What did you learn?" I said, "I learned that Christopher Columbus discovered America." And
yeah.
He said, "Sit down, son." He invaded America looking for gold and slaughtered a lot of natives.
Wow. Well, you had a father who was way ahead of his time. You know, I mean, I think most kids come home and they get patted on the head and say, "Well, that's very good," you know. I mean, and that's the end of it. And of course, in 1493, among other things, Columbus did something new. He hadn't done anything new in 1492. If you think about it, the Norse had already gotten here. They had been here for two whole years. They actually harvested lumber off of Newfoundland and probably off of Labrador for 300 years. So they were crossing the Atlantic routinely. But in 1493, he didn't just cross the Atlantic. He brought 17 ships. He took over the island of Haiti, renames it Hispaniola or Little Spain, and he proceeds to take over the whole island, take over several million people. And the population of Haiti then proceeds to go from probably about 3 million to probably about zero in terms of the native population by 1560. So he started the process of the transatlantic slave trade only from left to right, from west to east, namely in, shall we say, red people, in Native Americans. He doesn't get credit for that because, again, that might be controversial. That might be bad. But we can't have Columbus Day if we're going to be saying bad things about him. So we don't learn anything real about Columbus. We learn a bunch of unreal things like he proved it round. Well, any sailor already knew that the world was round, because you can see its roundness when a ship goes over the horizon as the roundness of the earth gets in the way. When it goes over the horizon, first you can't see the hull, then you can't see the sails, finally you can't see the little flag on top. So he didn't prove the world round. We knew it to be round. Instead, he started the slave trade. He did various other things that aren't quite so nice.
Well, we named the day after him, Columbus Day, as a holiday, but that's beginning to be changed with the people in this country saying we should really have a day in the memory of the indigenous natives of our land who were subjected to genocide, tribe after tribe wiped out, and others diminished.
A lot of states have actually, several states have switched, and a whole bunch of cities have switched, and they call it Native American Day or Indigenous Peoples Day. And you know what? It works just the same. You still go out and buy stuff, and capitalism works, and the system has a nice sale day, and it, you know.
Commercialism uber alles, yes.
Yes.
The next chapter is The Truth About the First Thanksgiving. I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah, well, we don't get Thanksgiving totally wrong. You know, Thanksgiving did actually kind of occur. There was this nice three-day get-together of the people that we now call pilgrims. They weren't called pilgrims back then. They were called the English, or they were called separatists. There's several interesting things about Thanksgiving, and this is coming out pretty soon, pretty well every November these days. Like last November, somebody wrote a whole kind of expose on Thanksgiving for the New York Times that relied a lot on what this chapter says in Lies My Teacher Told Me. The first thing that's kind of obvious is the United States didn't start in 1620. A lot of people kind of think it did. Well, you know, if we started with white folks rather than, say, with black folks or Native Americans, well, what about the Spanish who were in New Mexico and in Florida in the 1500s? Or if you have to speak English in order to count, well, then what about Virginia, you know, which gets founded in 1607? But besides that, now, of course, there's some things that happen in Virginia that cause us to not want to emphasize that so much. Let's talk about Massachusetts. It's nicer. But then we got to think about, why did the Pilgrims succeed so well in Plymouth, Massachusetts? And the reason, the key reason, is because it already had been a town. It had been a town called Patuxent. It had cleared fields. It had a nice cleared out spring. About 2,000 Native Americans had lived in this town. What happened to them? Well, just before the Pilgrims landed, in about 1615 or 16, there was a huge plague that swept through coastal New England, killed 95% of all the people. And in the case of Patuxent, now and soon to be Plymouth, the few remaining natives, they were so few and there were so many dead people, they just had to abandon the place. And the only guy who survived was a guy named Squanto. And we all know the story of Squanto. But the interesting reason why he survived was because he wasn't there at the time. He was from that village. But he was in England at the time. He had been stolen and enslaved. The slave trade didn't stop with Columbus. The British fishermen were continuing the slave trade of native people. So were other. The Portuguese stole so many people off of Labrador. They called it Labrador because that's the place they got laborers. And Labrador and laborer comes together in Portuguese. So that's why Squanto knew English, and that's why Squanto could interpret. He had been taken back to America by a really nice British fisherman. In other words, what I'm going to conclude by saying is the truth about the Pilgrims is more interesting than the kind of sanctimonious, wonderful meal that they fed to the Indians myth.
Well, let's go to John Brown and Abraham Lincoln, The Invisibility of Anti-Racism in American History Textbooks.
We can jump there. You actually kind of skipped the chapter. That is, there's a
just in
chapter.
The interest of time.
Yeah, I understand. There's two chapters about racism. The first one is the invisibility of racism. And the reason that that's important is because we talk about slavery. The textbooks are actually halfway good about slavery, I'm happy to say. They didn't used to be. But we did end slavery, didn't we? I mean, it's over. So it's kind of an American success story, even if it was terrible while it was going on. But racism, which is slavery's handmaiden, the ideology that accompanies slavery that makes it, quote, okay, unquote, that didn't just go away in 1863 or 4 or 5 whenever slavery ended in a given place. So you look in the textbook index, you don't even find racism under R, and it's not because of bad indexing. It's not treated very much. because it's a continuing problem and it's therefore controversial. Can't have any controversy. So I pair that chapter with Lincoln and John Brown because both of these people, of course, were anti-racist and they were certainly anti-slavery. But the way the textbooks treat them, they make one of them crazy, kind of still, kind of crazy. That's, of course, John Brown. He's getting a little better. He's now just a religious fanatic. He's not just plain crazy. And Lincoln, well, I ask audiences, I say, what do you think is the number one thing they quote about from Abraham Lincoln? What address, what speech, whatever? And audiences always say the Gettysburg Address, which is a good answer, but it's not the right answer. They love to quote this letter he wrote to this New York newspaper in the summer of 1862, where he says, what I do about slavery and the colored race, I do to hold the country together. And what I forbear to hold the country together. My only interest is in preserving the Union. That's what you're supposed to infer from that. Well, that's not even true. And one of the ways you know it's not true is because the very next sentence in the letter goes, well, what I have just written is my formal official capacity about slavery, but I mean no change whatsoever in my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere may be free. And they leave that out. And why would they do that? Why do they make Lincoln indifferent to slavery? Well, the answer is because they're still affected by this terrible period, 1890 to 1940, which is called the nadir of race relations. Some people say nadir, and I have to tell you, Ralph, I use a joke. I say, it's not N-A-D-E-R. We're not talking Ralph here. And the audiences always laugh, and I'm teaching them this new word, nadir, right? Nadir means, of course, low point with an I. And during this era, 1890 to 1940, we didn't want to talk about Lincoln's anti-racism because we had gone so racist, even in the North. So we just kind of left it out. And they're still doing it. They still copy the old textbooks from the past.
How much of this is due to they want to sell the textbooks in the South, which has a long memory?
Well, you know, it used to be that. That's exactly what it used to be. But I think that the textbook industry is just simply overcome by inertia. I continually get invitations to do workshops with school districts. For example, the North Carolina Statewide Council for the Social Studies. I've been invited repeatedly to South Carolina to speak, and I always speak there about the truth about why South Carolina seceded. I don't bother them about what Massachusetts gets wrong. I bother people in Boston, you know, with that. So I think that the South, the white South, is absolutely ready to move on. And we even see, of course, many of these cities now relocating or at least removing their Confederate monuments.
James Loewen and Ralph Nader. Speaking of Woodrow Wilson, Helen Keller, Christopher Columbus, the Pilgrims, and other lies your teacher told you. Thanks to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour for that selection from their interview. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, reminding you that war is not healthy for children and other living things, illegitimate non-carborundum, and, most importantly,
everything you know is wrong.
See you next time.